and welcome to the Adfontest podcast. Or should I say, welcome back from our summer break. We've been off for a few months, but we're back now. It's September. It's that back-to-school season. The leaves are falling, maybe, wherever you are in the world, if you're in the same hemisphere as me. And it's a college in the Bay Area. I don't think leaves ever fall in the Bay Area.
Never
knowingly fallen. But it's very good to have you here on the Adfontes podcast. Adfontes is a reader-supported podcast, so if you like what we do here and you want to see, listen to, read more of it, then go to adfontesjournal.com and you can subscribe there and get access to our quarterly print editions online or in the mail or the post, whichever you prefer, and our regular exclusive interviews as well from as little as $2.50 a month. So we would really value your support. As people know, the Adfontes podcast has changed a little bit, rebranded slightly. Our beloved host, Ansu Kamel, is not with us regularly, but will be here and there joining in. He's an editor at large. But I'm here with my colleague, Colin Redimer, poetry editor of Adfontes. Colin, and he's spoken up already. I don't even need to introduce him. Colin, are you well?
I'm very well, always, particularly because I get to see the smiling face of my friend, James Wood, Dr. James Wood, from calling in from Canada. Is that right, James?
That's correct. Yep.
A frozen north.
Fall's right. Yeah. We've just entered fall. It's very lovely here right now. So, do you guys have fall where you are, Colin? Do you know what that is?
No, we're, in Narnia, it's always winter and never Christmas. And in the Bay Area, it's always Christmas and never winter. So, it's just an eternal summer.
Very good. Yeah, we are joined by James Wood, as Colin says. Some of our listeners, I'm sure, will know James. He's written widely about a whole different host of things, including having written for us at Adfontes. And one of the things that we are going to do on the Adfontes podcast going forward is we've always said we're a writers and editors podcast. Largely, it's been an editors podcast. We've occasionally had people who have written for us, but not normally to talk about things they've written about. But we want to take advantage of all the intelligence and the wealth in the room and talk to some of our writers about the pieces that they've written. And we run a piece by James over the summer on the Adfontes website, How Abraham Kuyper Lost the Nation and Sidelined the Church. Bit of a spicy title. And so we're going to dive into that piece, which began life as a lecture at our Convivium Irenicum back in June. And so I'm going to turn it over to James. James, if you had to give me an elevator pitch for this lecture as it began and this piece that we edited it into, what is it about?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the spicy title got a little spicier in the Adfontes editorial drawing board room. So thank you for that, Reese.
We both bear responsibility for it, James, in the end.
So, I got interested in this figure, in this conversation for, I guess, a few reasons. One, I'm at a very Kuyperian institute. I'm at Redeemer. I teach at Redeemer University up here in Canada. It's a very neo-Calvinist inflected Kuyperian school. And we were hosting a Kuyper conference just before the Davenant Convivium. And I was trying to think about what I could offer, what particular things interest me that I could offer in conversation with the Kuyperians. And I guess I'm often a very polite controversialist. So I like to constantly stir the pot. And I do that always, even internal to my own tradition. My first piece I wrote for you at Adfontes was on Calvin's Catholicity, Calvin's ecumenism.
Calvin's complex ecumenism.
Yeah. And so kind of, you know, I wrote that also as a Presbyterian minister and saying, like, how do we actually fail in our Catholicity or ecumenism. And so that I'm critiquing my own tradition there as well, but also loving my tradition. Okay, so as a place where I also love Kuyper and admire him and benefit from him a lot, where do I think there are maybe some gaps in his thought? And I've been interested in political theology for quite a bit, particularly what's called the kind of general post-liberal conversations. And so you could kind of see him as a precursor to some of the conversations we're having, because you could kind of see Kuyper's free church, free state model that he began to articulate in the late 19th century is kind of setting the stage for a lot of modern Christian liberal politics.
Before I let you go any further, there's like so many terms going through here that I can imagine listeners are not going to be super familiar with. So just give us the big picture before we dive into the arguments. You know, you're very familiar with all the details and the inner workings of this. People who follow you closely also are. and you know, you have significant following online. You're a scholar who's, you know, writing in all kinds of outlets. So who's Abraham Kuyper? I think it'd be the quick version of that.
Oh,
because I reckon most people, if they know Kuyper, it's that one line.
Oh yeah,
good. It's such a kind of phrase. I can't even quote it properly, but you know, there's not an inch of creation over which Jesus Christ doesn't say mine, which appeared in 1001 sermons, probably applied to 1001 things that Kuyper never ever thought about. Who's Kuyper, and how do I spot a Kuyperian?
Who is he, and why is he relevant? I think for the contemporary, why is it that so many Americans in the 21st century are sort of talking about him? And then I think it's sort of then we can explain what your project is, which is actually significantly different than that.
Kuyper is extremely, he's a massively important figure. He was a theologian and politician in the late 19th century Netherlands. And so at the beginning of the turn of the 20th century, he was the prime minister for a little time. And so he's very successful politically, and he was also a very outspoken Christian. And so that's really interesting, I think, to a lot of people of like, how can you, in the modern world, how can you do both of those things? And so he provides a certain model, I think, for people. And then he's also a great rhetorician. I mean, he has these little slogans that get picked up. Reese referenced one of them, right? There's not a single square inch over all of creation over which Christ does not claim mine, right? And so that gets popularized. That's from his stone lectures at Princeton. That became very famous. And those stone lectures are very famous. And a lot of people's first introduction to his writings, if they actually go beyond the slogans, that will be the first place they go, because those were also the first things that were translated into English. And now there's just been a massive development, trying to publish all of his works in public theology. I think our friends at Lexham Press and the Acton Institute have been doing that and doing great work. They're beautiful books, by the way, and affordable for how beautiful they are.
I mean, we've got some reviews of those coming up.
Yeah,
that whole volume.
And if you're, let's say, you know, you and I have both been through seminary at some point in the last couple of decades, would you agree that, you know, basically, if you go to any Protestant seminary in America, you're gonna end up talking at some point with someone about Kuyper?
Yeah, let me say a couple more things about that. Yeah, and you will. He looms large in the room, just like Bart. I mean, if you do, if you're in Reformed schools, you're not going to get around those two names generally. If you're a conservative Reformed schools, you're definitely not going to get around Kuyper. He's a safe conservative for those who have somewhat accommodated to the liberal order. Okay, so I'll get to that later. Okay, so all right, that's the provocative part. But he himself, you know, a faithful confessional believer. We'll ask how confessional he was. That was part of my argument. But he did intend to be confessional, holding to the three forms of unity in that the Dutch churches adhere to. And so, but he's also really important. I'll say this, you know, because I do critique him here, but I also have a great admiration for him, right? I mean, he was very ambitious. I mean, and really did try to be a very faithful believer. But one of the things he did is, you know, he really tried to address what's called, you know, I didn't mention this in the piece, but he really did try to address, in maybe the most ambitious way among any Protestants among his contemporaries, this what's called the social problem, right? Like, you know, the Industrial Revolution hits, you know, massive social disruption in the 19th century. And then it causes the church to ask all sorts of new questions that it previously didn't have to answer, at least didn't have to attend to in an explicit, intentional way. And the Catholic Church responded to that, right, beginning with like Pope Leo XIII, with the emergence of what's called this Catholic social tradition. But Protestants didn't really have much of that in addressing those problems in this kind of robust way. And I know, you know, Davenant did a great job coming up with the Protestant social teaching. So finally, we have the answer. But until Davenant emerged on the scene and published that book, there wasn't
nobody had anything.
Nobody. And so, but there are answers there, but you know,
but I guess Protestants responded very actively, and you know, it's why activism is one of the four marks of being an evangelical. And so, you've got all, especially certainly in English history, the great social movements, you know, people going to poor houses, Wesley, poor schools, that kind of thing.
And he tried to provide a whole theory about that, you know. So I think activism is, that's one of Bedington's four pieces.
So there's an active response, but you say Kuyper, he's sort of one of the only guys taking any sort of intellectual chops to the social problem.
Or at least in kind of the most ambitious way. He starts with things like his book Ons Program, you know, our program. It kind of sets the terrain for the anti-revolutionary party of which he was a part, took over leadership from Gan van Pinster, who's a major figure.
That's his political party.
Yeah, the anti-revolutionary party would be, it's one of the ways that he tried to address the problems of modernity. He joined up with Gron von Prinster's project there. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why Kuiper is very, very important. But he also, so another slogan, a reason why I think he's important is like people trying to respond to the late modern liberal world where there's strong separation of church and state and increasingly more, you know, domestication of religion and marginalization to the private sphere, you know, but they want to still like claim that Christ is Lord. Well, Kuiper kind of gives you some resources to hold those ideas together mm-hmm. in a certain way. He wants to claim the comprehensive lordship of Jesus, but he also affirms something like another slogan of his is free church and a free state. Mm-hmm. And so he's a very Baptistic Presbyterian, you know, very Baptistic Reformed theologian.
Yeah, so what does that mean? A free church and a free state. And you mentioned this gets to your article. What are the implications of that for contemporary church state relations?
Yeah,
like when people use that slogan, you know, how does it work its way out?
Yeah, it's a strong separationism. I mean, you know, within the classical reform, one of Hodemacher's arguments is there's always been a distinction between church and state in civil and ecclesial community. That's not a new thing. For instance, I think I mentioned it in a footnote, but a really helpful work during the time of around the time of the Westminster Assembly is by George Gillespie's Aaron's Rod Blossoming, and he articulates very similar arguments that Hudemacher later picks up. Mm. But it clearly distinguishes between church and state. They are distinct powers, and that's even before classical Protestant thought. Just the Galatian diarchy, right? The two powers has been a long conversation within the Christian tradition. And they are not to be conflated. Mm-hmm. And so, but then a free church and the free state kind of radicalizes that. And it's a strong separationism, right? And largely, I think it emerges for good motivations that it emerges out of the Christians, faithful Christians trying to purify the church, right? And so get the state out of this, you know, the state gets, you know, the church gets domesticated by the state, you know, if it starts to take too much authority over the church. So they're trying to purify the church, but it would be a strong kind of separation. Let leave these two institutions leave each other alone. So
you see, reading through your piece and just some of the history of the state church in the Netherlands at the time, it's just when Kuiper's in power, it's sort of a century on from the end of the Napoleonic era when Holland was reconstituted and the House of Orange take over. And you have this new state church, which you kind of lay out, just became run by bureaucrats with no sort of real recognizable, you know, historic polity in place. And kind of true religious observance dies off. And Kuiper, he kind of felt to me reading that a bit of a kind of companion piece to Kierkegaard and the Danish church. There's this sort of, you know, loathing of kind of Christendom and half-assed faith, basically, in this you know desire for that kind of existentialist individual commitment and decision. Kuiper's solution to that, he has this very robust Christian idea of the public square and Christ's lordship over all things. He's not a kind of reductionist, which may be an anachronist way to talk about it, but what he wants, as you say, is a separation of state and church, free church and a free state, and that he thinks will lead to an enlivened church and hopefully a renewed public square with the church doing what it's meant to do. But then he has his friend and eventual foil, Hudemacher, not Hodemaker, as I thought it was, editing this piece. And so Hudemacher comes in. He's originally kind of working with Kuiper, but he develops some criticisms of Kuiper's desire for church and state to move away from each other. Could you flesh that out for us a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
introduce Hodemaker for the listeners as you do that.
Hodemaker.
Philippus Jacobus Hodemaker. Yeah, it's not easy. None of that flows off the tongue. Rolls off the tongue. But he was born. He was born in 1839. Died in 1910. So kind of throughout the 19th century, at the beginning of the 20th. Contemporary of Kuiper's, and was a prominent theologian and philosopher of his own right. It's fascinating. He kind of took an opposite track from someone like Bavinck. If you read the Bavinck bio, one of the ways that James Eglinton describes Bavinck's journey is, you know, he begins in the kind of established church and then goes to the separation, you know, to the seceding. Hudemacher is kind of an opposite journey. Mm. He was born into the separated church, a nonconformist church. Mm. And there was multiple stages. This is an earlier secession. But then he was ordained, I think in 1868. He was ordained in the National Church. And he felt, you know, already kind of there were the seeds of convictions about, you know, how do you restore public religion already there, but they get solidified in his work with Kuyper. And so he joins up with Kuyper. You know, they both are concerned about this lax Volkskirche, Kirk, they call it, you know, as disciplining power is taken away from ordained ministers and kind of put in the hand of state bureaucrats, which is a problem. Neither of them are satisfied by that. And it does kind of lead to a, you know, a Kierkegaardian concern, right? Well, then they start up this free institution, the Free University. But Kuyper
still going. We've got some friends who are there or have graduated from there.
Yeah, and so he linked up with him in 1880, and you know he thought that they were on the same page. You know, he was inspired by Kuyper's vision to submit all the disciplines, all knowledge to the Lordship of Jesus. But one of the things there were a couple things that bothered him from the outset. One, he started to notice that Kuyper seemed to be not very committed to pushing the National Church to receive graduates from the Free University into their ordination track. And so he starts saying, oh, okay, Kuyper's not as committed to the renewal of the National Church as I am. And then he became really concerned when Kuyper later, I mean, I guess this is after, but he started to see that, you know, Kuyper was, 1885, Kuyper was starting to leave an exodus out of the church, what's called the Dolianti, where he, you know, about, I think, 10% up to 10% of the National Church exited because of their frustrations. And so then the kind of writing was on the wall. Hudemacher increasingly became convicted that, okay, we need to revivify the National Church for a lot of reasons. And so I'll pause there, but there's a lot of reasons why that is. But he started to see the writing was on the wall, that they were at odds. And so eventually within that year, he exited the Free University.
So if I sort of get the map of the territory correct, then, you know, Kuyper is sort of saying we have a historic National Church and that's not going to work in sort of liberal modernity. And so that church has to sort of diminish, die, perhaps. I mean, he's not trying to kill it, but he sort of says the church needs to go be this other way and goes and sets up an institution that's sort of outside of the political sphere so that the political sphere can do what it's doing well and the church can do what it's doing well. Yeah. And Hudemacher, and I'm probably saying it wrong still because I'll always say it wrong because I don't know these people and I don't speak Dutch. You know, he's saying, whoa, 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 just because we're in modernity, you know, just because we have these new sort of ways of thinking about politics doesn't mean that Christianity can't think about the contemporary situation or something along those lines. Is that right?
Yeah.
So he's sort of saying that there's resources in the tradition to be able to do this a different way. We don't just have to sort of, you know, give the political game away to secularism or something.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things going on in his logic for staying. I mean, first of all, he didn't think he thought that the situation in the National Church was problematic and he was distraught by it, but he didn't think it was dead yet. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's like, look, all these, there's just too many impatient reformers. I mean, that was my very first piece for Ad Fontes is about this. I mean, like I want to retrieve the early reformers' view of reforming the church, not just endlessly splintering off into smaller and smaller circles of purity. I mean, I don't think that was the original vision of the reformers. So now I've triggered a lot of your audience. It is what it is. And so those are my convictions that I share with Hudemacher. And so, you know, he was like, look, it's not dead yet. It still bears the marks of a true church in a limited sense. And so is there an opportunity to revivify it? And I share some of these convictions. I think because one of the problems is what happens, and you see this in all these denominations, is once the kind of confessional Orthodox group abandons the big body, there were problems there for sure, but it sets that trajectory. Now it's inevitable, right? Mm-hmm. Because now there's no voice of resistance. And to be honest, it's not always clear that it was always that we were always going to lose. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's concerned about impatient reformers, and then I can get to the politics, but I think internal, just even internal to the church.
Sure, sure. I mean, Aaron Wren will write about this, and he'll talk about how, you know, for every, you know, there's like how many church plants go into Chicago or New York or San Francisco, and they're going to plant a new Baptist church. Meanwhile, there's like a huge, beautiful Baptist church building, yeah, like right there. You know, these people could just be putting their energy into that and like making this historic, yeah, institution, you know, vibrant, mm-hmm, and faithful and growing.
As an Englishman, this just has so many kind of points of resonance, and so,
but much more practical for you.
Yes, indeed. Well, yeah, but I'm born and raised in a nonconformist church, and that's where I am, regardless of, you know, whether I would on paper die for the principles of nonconformity. That's a different conversation. But you know, this exodus from the established church, this debate between these two figures of, should we stay or should we go? You know, defining moment in sort of recent British evangelical history is in 1966 when John Stott and Martin Lloyd-Jones had this exact, yeah, disagreement. James knows what I'm talking about. That's good. It's one of those things that like feels huge for us here, probably basically no Americans ever heard of. But you know, Martin Lloyd-Jones stands up at this meeting, yep, and says, all the evangelicals lead the Church of England and let's form one big evangelical kind of, you know, mega denomination and just crack on. And Stott, who's not even going to be speaking, it's just moderating, it feels so strongly, a very mild man, you know, didn't do this kind of thing, often stands up and says, no, we need to stay. Question of, you know, which one has proved right? That's the subject for dissertation. sadly have not yet been written. But yeah, it's bizarre to see it happen. This is what, 1886 is the Dolly Antti exodus?
Yeah,
80 years before this happens in England. Mm-hmm. It's happening there, and it's you know. But so look, seeing this, so the points of resonance here with kind of current Christian political discourse are obvious to those who keep up with those conversations, which is for us, yeah,
it's obvious for you, but how does this work for me? I mean, I don't have a state church. This is America, right? Isn't it all just
you have the main line?
It's pluralism all the way down, right, James?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I gesture at that towards the end, right? I mean, it definitely is not going to map on. So we'll have to get to the politics, but we haven't got to that part yet, mm-hmm, before we can actually even try to articulate what are the principles that we could learn from. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's different context, but I think it's always refreshing to see how these types of debates were addressed in different contexts, right? Even if, and so I think it's generative. It's the same reason why I like to read theology outside of my tradition. It's just like, how are they using kind of different terms to address some of the same questions? Even if I can't fully adopt any particular party's stance, it's generative for my imagination.
But then James,
you could look at just the 20th century. Like, we did have a soft mainline establishment, so that's our recent history. It's not a hard establishment; it's a soft, mm-hmm, mainline, especially at a more national level. So we could ask, like, is there a way to revivify that? But the further question, the more fundamental or preliminary question is, do we even want that? Right? I mean, I think that's convincing a lot of our friends. Would that even be something you'd want? And I think a lot of our friends would say no. I mean, and that's what Hudemacher, I think that is a very relevant point. He's like, I end the article with a quote from that. He's like, is this something you would even desire if God deigned to bring it about? Would you even see that as a blessing? Like, and I think most of our contemporaries would say no. So you have that in the 20th century, but then earlier you have stronger establishments, at least at the level of the state. And that's where it does map more nearly to the situation in the Dutch Republic, because it was a much, and that's why it's always hard to look at these and think about the United States, because the United States is a, you know, it's a big confederation of multiple smaller states, and those smaller states are closer in size and cultural dynamics to these individual nations that we're looking at over here. And so I do think, and we did have certain state establishments, and so that's where it could there be a closer connection there.
Said, you know, it's helpful to look back and see sort of similar debates being had in different terms, but just one of the things I found remarkable in reading your piece and some of the quotes is actually, like, the terms seem really recognizable. And I guess, you know, this is 110-ish years ago, 120 maybe. Yeah, this is full late modernity. You know, we are more, yep, we are more like the world Hudemacher and Kuyper were in, they're closer to us than they were to like the reformers, let's say.
That's right.
In kind of both the actual fabric of the world they lived in, as well as, you know, the actual amount of time. You know, Houdemakers says things like, you know, in your piece, I do not believe in the neutral state. It is an impossibility. You know, that could have come out of any number of kind of, you know, conservative Christian think pieces right now. And so one of the struggles with when you're getting into, that I've found over the last several years, trying to get into historic kind of reformed political theology, is when you say, do jump back to the Reformation, some of the terms are, they use the same terms and they don't mean really the same thing that we mean now. Nation states are just becoming a thing, or they're talking about the civil magistrate, words we don't use. Some of their ideas are so alien to us, you know, what two kingdoms theology really was, Brad, our president, has done work on that and written a great Davenant guide about it. But it's so hard to get you into that headspace. Whereas, and then real reformed theology often seems to sort of just drop away for a while. And the assumptions of liberalism become very prevalent very fast, it seems to me. Yeah. Houdemaker, from what you expose of him, seems to be have a kind of grasp on a historic reformed theology, and is talking about it in terms in the late 1800s, which we still understand now.
Thanks, Reese. That's a good bridge of like why I think he's really appealing to me, and why I think also Kuyper is appealing, because the whole orthodox but modern thing that, you know, if people have slapped onto the neo-Calvinist school is a kind of a summary of what their project is trying to accomplish, to be orthodox but yet modern. That's, people use that for Kuyper and Bavinck. And I think they use a lot of language that seems very familiar to us. Like we can recognize those conversations. But I think why Houdemaker is fascinating to me is I think he's also orthodox, but yet within modernity. It's like he's recognizing the problems, the same problems that Kuyper and Bavinck are trying to recognize. But I think I do think he anticipates some of the issues in their political solutions.
You've sort of alluded to that a couple of times. So what are the political, you know, what is the political situation or the political problem and the political solutions?
Yeah, so like why I think it's so hard to like jump back, right, as Reese was mentioning, like just to say, well, let's just jump back to the magisterial reformers. Like that was just a completely different milieu. I mean, those nation states emerged as Protestant states, and most people were very happy about it, or, you know, so it was, there was just a lot of presuppositions that were assumed in the emergence of these states. And so it's like, okay, of course, well, the state should be Protestant and the state should be reformed, whatever.
There's still medieval people. There's a lord over there in the castle. Obviously, it's not even contested. Yeah.
And so these guys, I think, they're on the cusp of the great contestation, right? Like that's all fizzling out. And now you're having to make your case. And so you can recognize the terms there of like fighting, you know, the idea of neutrality. Like, I mean, that a public order could be ordered around religious neutrality, and that the state and church should be strongly separated, that that you should enshrine the will of the majority, popular sovereignty, you know, majoritarianism is the way you would think about how politics is performed. I mean, those are just all, and so Kuyper and Houdemaker, they're in that world, and that's the world that we still inhabit. And I think they provide alternative paths. I think Kuyper's solution, free church, free state, you know, more majoritarian the politics, like just kind of working within, just kind of to some degree comfortably working within that liberal order, and then kind of setting up separate institutions. This was a big concern later. Of one spicy quote that's included in the piece is Houdemaker says, "I view the Christian school as an idol of the Christian people." And one of the reasons why is like, look, you've abandoned the pursuit of ordering public institutions to the truth. Mm-hmm. You just completely abandoned it. And so you're not even trying anymore. And so they just had all, you know, he's like, look, keep fighting to order public institutions to the truth. But he accepts the fact that it's going to be contested. And that's one of the things I love about Houdemaker. He's not naive about that.
So if I was to sort of try applying that, you would say, you know, there's a certain retreatism that happens if you make a claim that the public square is going to be neutral, or that we have to sort of accept pluralism.
Yeah.
And then we're going to sort of build our own little Christian school. Let's talk, because you mentioned schools, right? I send my kids to a private Christian school because we can't trust the seculars or whatever, but we have to just accept the secularity because that's just the reality. You sort of, that approach, which you're saying is sort of more Kuyperian, it actually is, it has a sort of presumption that isn't necessarily true. In other words, secularity is not inevitable. I think we're seeing this now, right? There's an interesting piece that just came out on First Things. It says, as you sort of secularize, and you and I were talking about it on Twitter, as the world secularizes, you know, actually secularity doesn't last very long, right? Like, because there's a sort of native natural religion internal to humans that just emerges out of them. Yeah. And so if we all take our kids and we send them to the private Christian schools, that means that the quote unquote secular schools are not going to be secular for very long. They're going to adopt some other religion. That's right. They're going to become very long.
They aren't anymore.
Right. Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. They have little idols. They have their own flags, you know, et cetera. And so even if I, you know, would Hodemaker at least make, because I would agree with you on that completely, but I would say, isn't there a prudential case? Like there's a prudential case for sending your kids and, you know, helping educate, you know, kids in the church.
Yep.
Even while you're sort of activating to try to make sure that there's a Shekinah or whatever of Christian norms for your society that everybody else can abide by, or something along those lines. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And is Hodemaker saying the same thing that some Christian parents will say now, and the whole should you send your kids to public schools debate comes up, which is we send them in there to be little missionaries. Like Hodemaker's still in a kind of renewal, revival, not dead yet. These people are regenerate Christians kind of state. Whereas now when this whole thing of keep your kids in the schools comes up, those who are intentional about keeping kids in public school, and like most parents aren't, you just have to go to whatever the school is and get on with it and hit and hope for the best. But those who are intentional, it's like, no, send them in to be missionary, to be salt and light. Is that
I'm a Jesuit at heart. I prefer my missionaries to be the governor.
No, he's not saying that. At least I have never seen him say that. And I think that there is a profound, I'll make it very clear, I think there's a profound naivety about that, and also parental abdication. Not of sending your kids to public schools, because I think there's public schools where that could work.
Yeah.
But the idea that your kids are little missionaries, I think, is profoundly, it's an abdication. It's neglect, I think. You're sending your kids as sheep among wolves.
As a default posture. Yeah.
Not so. Again, my point was not about public schools. It was about the way, even if you send your kids there, you shouldn't primarily be thinking about it as an evangelist. Right? Yeah. Anyway, but so no, he's not saying that. And I would say to Colin, your point about the prudential case and like your calculations you're making now, I think what Kuyper or what Hudemacher is saying is that the dilemma you're facing now is the way it is because we abandoned them 120 years ago.
Yeah.
And so he's saying it has gotten so bad, right? Again, it's like the denomination thing. If you leave, you at a certain point, you set the trajectory. And so I think that would be his point is like, look, Hudemacher saying 120 years from now, Colin's going to have to send his kids to little pagan indoctrinations centers, or, you know, they're going to have to get those little siloed sets. And he's saying that's not inevitable. We could stop that.
Right.
And so at that point, at that juncture, I think he's arguing it is actually much more prudential to stay and try to fight to order these institutions to truth, especially in a situation in the Netherlands where that is their history and you could appeal to it. And so I think a lot of people now, right, they're revisiting it. They're getting more in America, right? They're revisiting their history and they're trying to retrieve those sources. And now we're having to make some calculations that are a little bit different, but I think people can still follow Hudemacher in trying to make a robust articulation of how public institutions should be ordered. What is our history? Is there a legacy here that we can retrieve? But at the level of the individual parent, I think they're going to have to make prudential calculations in their situation. And I think Hudemacher would be supportive of that.
So are they, you know, one of the things that I always notice when I interact with people who work in, the Dutch Reformed world of historical theology is that every time I talk to somebody, I learn of another, you know, brilliant Dutch theologian that I should know something about that I've never heard of. Are there other figures that, you know, sort of loom in these conversations? I, you know, if you know anything about any era, you always know it's not two guys talking to one another. There's a crowd, you know.
I'm still a little new to this world. I mean, I would say the Kuiper's most famous critic is Skilder, but that comes later. Klaas Skilder.
Never heard of the guy.
K-L-A-A-S and then S-C-H-I-L-D-E-R. He was his most famous critic, but in the next generation, but he primarily critiqued just the whole theology of common grace. And Hudemacher doesn't narrow in so much on that. And I think that there are problems, limitations to that framework, but I don't think it's as problematic as Skilder does. But Skilder is also one of the reasons I'll just share a little introduction to me as Please. Well is one of the reasons I was so passionate about Hudemacher is he's both a kind of proto post-liberal. So he's critiquing kind of the assumptions of modern secular liberalism. And again, I think one of the comments I was gonna make there, I forgot to make earlier. You said like, yeah, I mean, I think we're all post-liberal now in a sense. I mean, that's the Great Awakening, the successor ideology is exposing liberalism as unsustainable. And that's secular liberalism is unsustainable. Mm-hmm. There will always be a God that, you know, God that enters the public sphere. Leslie Newbegin, one of my life heroes, mm-hmm. Reformed missiologist, he has a little phrase. He's like, look, we can recognize plurality as a fact without endorsing pluralism as an ideology. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is very helpful. And I think that's what Hudemacher admits as well. And I think Kuiper elides those to some degree. And so, but anyway, so for me, he's a proto-post-liberal, and so he anticipates some of the conversations we're having now, and he tries to resist the naivety of kind of secular liberal frameworks. But then also at the same time, he really centers in on the life of the church and the unique social body that the church is. And that's I'm really passionate about that. That's kind of my project along with Peter Lighthart, you know, our podcast, the Civitas podcast, is we like the post-liberal conversation. One of the things that seems to be missing in a lot of it is a robust doctrine of what the church is and its unique social nature. And so Hudemacher is really promising on that front. And the reason why I brought that up in reference to Skilder is that also is an overlap of Skilder. But Skilder kind of goes a little bit more of an Anabaptist type direction. Mm-hmm. And Hudemacher resists that. Mm-hmm. So he'd be another one. There's A.A. von Ruler. I haven't read him, but I know that he followed. I think he tried to follow Hudemacher as well. But Hudemacher's project kind of dissipated a little bit. It got overshadowed by Kuiper. I mean, Kuiper's just a towering personality, was very successful in his time. And I will say this too. I think why it's worth revisiting Kuiper or revisiting this debate is because I think for a long time, and you know, this is sensitive to probably Reese, but for a long time, it was easy to think, oh, Kuiper's framing was more successful. It worked free church, free state. Look, in America, we have a free church, free state. It's complete disestablishment. Like, you know, and the civil religion kind of dies off in the mid 20th century. And look, we have more robust spirituality. We have more robust church attendance rates. And some of that is still kind of true. And like, mm-hmm. then people look at like, oh, look at the UK. Like they have they have an established church and, you know, their rates of religious observance is much worse than ours. Mm-hmm. But I think we're seeing now, is that inevitable? I mean, are we just on the tail end of that experience? And we might see rapid secular, who knows? Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people are revisiting that kind of that assumption. And then the other question there is not just the question for a lot of these things, the question about like public recognition of the truth of Christ's lordship and all that. The question is not just centered on personal religious observation, but also like public morality, like which is a good in and of itself. It's not an ultimate good, right? We want people to know Jesus and spend eternity with him. But provisionally, temporally, penultimately, we also want
it's great not having home invasions. You know?
Try. There you go. So I'll pause there. Reset. You know.
But just on that. So yeah, that's you know. If we say that. Oh, let's look at these two trajectories: America, free church, free state. Free churches, free state.
Yeah. There you go.
Isn't that you know proven to be more fruitful? UK national church decline. Yeah, like I've alluded to the
so painful.
Yeah, I mentioned the whole Stott Lloyd Jones disagreement in the UK, and I mean off the back of that, you know, many people evangelical Anglicans stuck with Stott and stayed in the Church of England, and you know where there is growth and things going well and solidity in the C of E, it's with the evangelicals. A lot of it with the charismatic evangelicals. and yet the institution has been lost. Like they didn't leave. They stayed, and still, let's be honest, the institution's been lost. Now, arguably, they weren't where they were directing their efforts whilst they stayed. May have been part of the problem. Lack of intellectual minds, lack of kind of, you know, a serpent-like wisdom of the levers of power and getting into bishoprics and archdiaconates and whatnot. So, you know, or maybe they stayed but just didn't do anything. But we've got to be willing to say maybe, you know, okay, maybe one of these positions is in principle the right one, but it may still work out terribly. You know, what was the right kind of theological political move for Moses? It was go to Pharaoh and say, let my people go. What happened? They had to make bricks of that straw, and things got way, it's just stuck in my pastor preached on Exodus last year and got to that episode. His main point for that sermon was things could get worse. And so we need to be able to say, like,
classic British optimism.
Yeah, but, you know, maybe sticking and staying, maybe that's the right thing. But maybe it won't work for reasons that are beyond your control. Or maybe the free church, free state, maybe that is the right thing. Maybe it could all still go disastrously, but that doesn't mean it's the wrong approach to take.
Yeah, we're dealing in alternative histories and counterfactuals, which are inherently unprovable.
And the fact that, you know, the Doliente thing happened in the 1880s and the big Stop Lloyd-Jones disagreement happens in the 1960s. So maybe they waited years too late and that disagreement should have been happening, I don't know, in Ryle's day or whatever, and probably was to some degree. But
Yeah, so my thoughts about, you know, about that point is, again, these things are alternative stories are unprovable. But, you know, to some degree, also those trajectories are set once all the Orthodox people leave. That's part of my argument. And I just think, like, as Orthodox, more trad people, if they stay in the denominations. And so we'll get to, like, what do you do now?
Trad is speak for traditionalist, those listeners that are less.
They're the ones having the babies. I mean, they're the ones who are really committed. If you have a 50-year view, you could reconquista, you know, as some say. I mean, I think you could in some situations.
Yeah. Well, that is arguably still sort of a trajectory-ish for things in the Church of England that
their trajectory is not set. I mean, and so, like, there's an opportunity for reform. So, but the other thing I would say is, I have a piece coming out in Comment Magazine on this particular issue in the next print edition. And, it's on the virtues of staying put. And I'm really informed by Ephraim Radner there, who's on my doctoral committee. He's over at University of Toronto, Wycliffe College. And he has famously, he's one of the most outspoken conservative voices, in all of Anglicanism in the world. Especially on marriage, right, and some ordination issues, but he stayed in the Episcopal Church, or its equivalent in Canada, which is the ACC. And his whole theology, his whole framework is: I'm a voice in the wilderness, and I'm here, and I'm going to stay until they kick me out. But I'm not going to stay silent. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't try to recruit people to come with him, but then he also articulates a virtue of staying put, like I was ordained here. So, like, I'm not asking everybody to, you know, wherever you are, like, everybody to leave. Like, I'm not going to leave. I'm ordained the PCA. I'm not going to go to the PCUSA. But I'm definitely going to resist the inclination, even in the contemporary PCA, to split even further. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, mm-hmm. And I do think that's so as we keep, you know, joining these sectarian, you know, movement or these movements of separation with the hopes of. Sometimes we will justify it by saying we want to revive, you know, the church, but oftentimes what happens is it's more purity spirals.
Yeah,
and then the same thing happens in the next denomination you're in, and I want to oppose that with all my might. So
yeah, I've got a number of thoughts. So one is the micro denomination phenomenon is sort of not ideal. It's suboptimal, and so. You know, one place.
We're talking about hot dog church.
No. Hot dog church is that's just the American church, man. That's the American church in its most primal form. But I think about the fights going on in the SBC, right? And actually, I take some hope from this that there's a group who's trying to fight for it. They're not just saying let's go.
Yeah, who's leaving? Micro.
Yeah, exactly.
It's fascinating.
Right.
Exactly. She's leaving this summer. It's the people who if you were just waging the war online and you were like, oh man. And you just are really despairing about how the church keeps liberalizing and it's always going in this direction. Oh, man. Mm-hmm. And we've got certain big name figures behind us man, and then you go in the vote for the SBC, it was like 90%.
Right. Mm. So there's a, and that takes a sort of, you know, concerted organizing, and it's controversial. It's not without its sort of people, opponents who think that this is not something you should do, but that's, you know, it's just part of how political organizations function. And on some level, when you're going to be a denomination, you're doing something like politics. I think another thing that you said, just to sort of put a pin in that, is, you know, you talked about the baby bomb hypothesis, that somehow, you know, if you have, you know, demographics over 50 to 100 years where, you know, certain belief systems produce less children than others. And if that could be demonstrable, I was reminded of a certain dissident outlet that published a very cryptic account of a biology conference that happened at UC Berkeley this summer.
Okay.
And apparently, and I don't know, I genuinely do not know who it was, but one of the leading American or leading biologists in the field of like intelligence research or whatever actually has converted to Christianity and hasn't told anybody. And he ended up having like a little lecture about why it was late one evening at this conference, sort of behind closed doors with a certain subset of the community or whatever. And his part of his reason was, it is clearly an evolutionary advantage to believe in God and participate in organized religion. And everybody there was like jaws on desk, like shocked to hear this person say it. And, you know, and so they're not sort of out in public as a Christian, but they are a practicing Christian. And in part, it's because the demographics are incredibly clear, right? If you believe in God, if you practice in an organized religious community, you have more children. And it's kind of obvious in some sense. You have a certain hope. There's certain obligations that are social. You're in a community who can help you care. I mean, so there's all sorts of reasons for it that we don't have to go into right now. I have a sort of question, and maybe it'll tie into some of these things, maybe it won't. Reese has talked about how he sees the Hodemaker-Kuiper thing having sort of clear one-to-one implications for English history. You have said, and have agreed, it doesn't map perfectly to America. But if you had to sort of think of places or individuals, you know, where we can sort of position this, how do you see it playing out either now or at some point in the American, you know, historical scene for listeners who maybe don't know anything about the Dutch scene, but know a little bit about American church history?
Well, at the church level and then at the political level, I'll answer those a little separately, you know, is the church level. I'd be like, there's reasons to be hopeful about the big, more confessional or at least more conservative denominations. I don't lose hope. I mean, the SBC's trajectory, you know, it looks scary. And it's like, okay, well, fascinating. I mean, like, there's reasons to be hopeful there. The PCA went through a hard few years, but I'm pretty bullish on the PCA right now. We've made some really good moves. I'm praying for our friends in ACNA, and then praying for our friends in the LCMS. I think they're facing some uphill battles in the near future. But the LCMS, you know, one of its strengths, right, is it's fast. It's very different because it doesn't map neatly with Hoedemaker either, because it doesn't really try to be recognized publicly, but it's just quietly faithful. It's just a huge denomination that you never hear about.
But it is, I actually was thinking about the LCMS because I think historically they had a moment that was sort of like this, where they had, they had to sort of, this is my understanding, is that there was a certain point in the 1900s, I think it was like the mid 1900s, when they're realizing that there's all this liberalization, you know, liberal theology, modern theology, and they basically, you know, have a community that is at the center of the organization that's like, no, like we're saying no to all of that. That's not Christianity.
Yeah.
We have to sort of maintain orthodoxy. And then they retake not just the LCMS, but also certain seminaries and colleges that were sort of drifting, that were sort of falling off the wagon.
And, Wren's documented that really well. Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. And so they might be sort of struggling at the moment. They have all kinds of struggles, but they're an example, I think, historically of a group that did it. It's like they actually pulled it off.
And so there's that. So at the church level, I would just say, guy, like if you're in one of those denominations and you're discouraged, just stay the track, like stay in, like keep fighting, like it's not over. Like, and as all these other all these other denominations die, I mean, like so many of the, and I don't pray for, I wish those, my prayer for all these like liberalizing dying denominations is that they would return to orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And maybe some people who are therein do a little Reconquista thing. And I would prefer that than just the PCA wins out, you know? That's my hope. And then somehow we see some sort of various reunions that we all can't imagine right now. And there's no plan for that. And so that's at the church level. So keep hope, keep fighting, because there's reasons to be hopeful. But then the political level.
Shout out to Margaret and Michael Ruttimer, who raised me in the main line with this is sort of what they would whisper with no really theological training at the seminary level at all, just like reading the Bible and, you know, Christian American practice. And they're like,
I know people who are very
care about this church.
That's right. And I know people who are very, I mean, like we were in Connecticut, which is just filled with all the rainbow churches.
That's where I was raised. Yeah.
And UCC, Connecticut. I was in there for the last couple of years, and it was fine. You know, my father-in-law is an Episcopal minister. You know, I've documented that. People have heard that in podcasts and things like that. But we're very close, and we differ a ton. And so, but I would attend from time to time. I'd go to his church. It was really fun to meet, like the vibrancy in their church are actually young families that are way more conservative than the denomination. Mm-hmm. And they're in there. And like, guys, like, who knows what's going to happen in that church over the next 30 years? I mean, like, and so I'm not saying everybody go into that, but if you're in it, man, like you could, and I know like there's this one family who came out of Mormonism, was our friends. And now they're really passionate, like, you know, traditionalist Christians, and they happen to find themselves in that church. But like, they are a centerpiece in that church, like a huge centerpiece. They do all the volunteering. They have more kids than everybody. I mean, it's like, who knows what that little congregation could do, you know? Sure. So there's that. And then on the political side, yeah, I mean, I think you have places where you could be a little bit more optimistic about kind of a revived public Christianity. And, you know, Peter Lighthart likes to say, you know, he lives in Birmingham, Alabama. It's a Baptist integralism, you know? And so there's a, you know, encourage Baptists to take ownership of it, right? In those places where you have a real stamp on the culture, to be confident about that.
Great start. I think it's a great place to finish.
love the Lord, love your church, you know.
And love, I even said nice things about Baptists. I wasn't ready for that. So.
Strange things happen on the Ed Fontes podcast, you know.
For the record, you quoted Peter Lighthart saying nice things about Baptists. I think
that's right. That's true.
Pivot now to talking about what we're reading. We've been talking about, you know, what we do for a living, stuff that we
quick pause. Our do we still do that in these interviews?
Or what now in the post Auntie Camel age? We hadn't decided. Colin and I were trying to come up with fresh, funny bits, guys. Like, this is a little window into how the sausage is made. Maybe Colin will not want me to, you know,
pull
the curtain back. Yeah. So if there's funny stuff you want me and Colin to do, if you want us to have like a fart noise soundboard or whatever, you know, let us know. But Colin, do you not want to talk about what you're reading? Do you want to talk about something else you're doing? Let's talk about what were you lifting today, Colin?
Oh, I was gonna lift, but I woke up too late, so I'm planning to lift.
Tell the people where you go. All Colin told me is normally I get up and I go and lift at my kid's school, and what I imagined was like an Absalom like scene of Colin sat in the gate saying, "Hey kids, don't go to the teacher. I'll teach you all you need to know."
See, what you need to do is you need to go reconquista the public schools by lifting in front of the public school kids and inspiring them with your vitalism.
Yeah. No comment.
You need to grow your mustache back, and then you'll be like Ned Flanders with the muscle, but also with the humility before the Lord. There we go. Well, I've raised it now, so we this week we'll talk about what we're reading. But if listeners have suggestions for you know, new bits and things you'd like us to add in, please do let us know. But James, you're our guest. What have you been reading? What's on the nightstand?
Yeah, I mean, nothing really kind of cool and edgy, but I have a lot of projects that I got to complete, and one of them is. Big project is I'm teaching a class on Augustine's City of God next year, senior seminar.
Great fun.
Class next semester. And so I'm
preparing a lot of cooking prep for 2 years, right? I remember when you were
there. I can't speak to the exact project that's also going to come out of it, but there's a publication opportunity that I'm looking at. And so, but one of the things I've been trying to do is not only rereading through the City of God, which I'm doing, but also
that's what's taking you 2 years, isn't it? Just
reading. No, yeah, and then also, you know, looking back over, you know, secondary sources, Peter Brown's bio. But I would say the really fun thing that's connected also to Davenant as well is I'm doing after my Bible time in the morning, I'm a good evangelical, is I'm also reading Augustine's sermons, which has been really fun, just kind of trying to get Augustine in my bones. But I know Davenant is offering a class on Augustine's sermons with our friend Matthew, and so, you know, encourage listeners to check that out.
I'm taking it.
And then the only other thing is I have a writing project due on Bovink's newly translated Reformed Ethics. And so, so I'm working on that. That's really fun. And I have a lot of positive things to say about it, I'm sure. And so, yeah, those are the two major things I'm working on right now.
Okay. So you're reading to work right now, are you, James?
Yeah. I haven't had a lot of fun reading. The other book, I guess that's different. That's more fun, but it's also related to another project is on the podcast. We are right after this today. We're having Nancy Piercy on to talk about her new book on the toxic war of masculinity. And I just reread through that the second time, and man, it's a really good book. So I really enjoyed that. So it's kind of for fun, but
yeah, I've heard very good things.
I always feel like it's a win when I end up in a position where I get to read things I enjoy reading for work. It's like I get to read, which I was going to do anyway, but now they pay me. You know, that's a win. Well, just this last week, I've been teaching through I'm teaching another one of these sort of Renaissance, early modern thought classes, and we did Galileo's Starry Messenger, and the line that struck me from it was that he talks about how, you know, the moon, the stars, and the sun are so much more luminous, and the other planets, Venus, are more luminous than Earth, but if we could see the Earth from space, we would see that the Earth is as luminous as all of them. And it is not the sink of all refuse, which is a quote. He's sort of paraphrasing what his medieval opponents would say. And students struggled with it so much. But of course, anybody who's familiar with Lewis knows immediately what's going on, because their default position is to think that the medievals thought the Earth was the center. They were so self-centered. They thought the Earth was, you know, all that, and everything else is sort of out there and unimportant. But actually, no, Galileo has it correct. You know, the medievals thought the Earth was the sink of all refuse, almost, right? They thought it was sort of lower, less important in some sense.
It's at the bottom of the thing.
That's right. And God is somehow sort of out there on the edge. He's in here with us too, but he's like really out there. So it was just a beautiful line that encapsulates what Lewis then rearticulates to modern people, which is that we've sort of forgotten the medieval mindset, which is that we're lowly, right? And God is sort of higher up. So that was one of the pieces of my reading that I thought would be valuable for the listeners. Reese, what are you reading?
Yeah, I have actually been able to do some reading for fun. We had a baby at the start of July, and when we had our last one, he needed to be held up for like 40 minutes every time he had a feed because he was super gassy. So I used that time to read Wuthering Heights, like pick a classic novel I've never read. And this time around, I was like, okay, let's try and do something similar. So I spent a lot of time whilst holding a baby. Read Jane Austen for the first time this summer. I say that yesterday, Colin tweeted out saying, Jane Austen is mid.
Jane Austen is mid.
Yeah, but I've been Austin pilled. It's great.
Oh, you know? No!
But isn't mid? I feel like the meme irony trajectory is mid is almost a compliment now, right?
Well, you know, it's almost turned into that. Worse. That's
I'll take mid.
Mids
rise up. Mids unite.
I'm just a mid.
Yeah.
I read Pride and Prejudice, and just I found it hilarious. I don't laugh out loud reading very often, but I laughed out loud a lot reading Pride and Prejudice. And now I'm reading Mansfield Park, which is also great fun. So I'm glad to have finally got there. You know, I'm sort of scandalized by the fact that I went through an English undergrad degree and was never made to read Austin. Like, you know, this shouldn't have been allowed to happen, as far as I'm concerned. Like,
undergrad degree in England.
In England, wow. Let alone. In the, like, wow. You know, not far from Bath.
Decline.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the establishment failed me, and now, in true Davenant Institute fashion, I'm autodidactically soaking myself in the tradition. There we go. Austin at last. That's me. Okay. Well, we will begin to wrap up now. We'll drop one of our favorite. One of our favorite bits has always been people telling Colin telling people what they should do if they didn't like the episode. But in this new era of the Ad Fontes podcast, maybe that's not what people want to hear. Colin, give us a positive word. What should people do if they like this episode?
If you like this episode, you should go move to some, benighted European country and join the state church, get ordained, rise up, become the head of it, and then reconquista, the father or motherland, unless your parents aren't from there, and then you just reconquista something.
And tell people that you were inspired to do that by...
By James Wood.
On...
On the Ad Fontes podcast. That's right. Sorry, I apologize. That's right. And five star reviews. In all seriousness, the rate review the podcast if you liked it. It is incredibly helpful to surfacing the podcaster and iTunes and Spotify and anywhere else that fine podcasts can be received. And I would also like to plug the podcast that that our friend James here is on with Peter Lighthart. They recently had, was it O'Donovan on?
Yep.
And,
yeah,
fantastic work. Where can they find it?
It's on all the podcast platforms. But yeah, do regularly subscribe also to the Ad Fontes podcast. I'm a regular listener myself. So,
thank you. Good to hear. And if you want to support the work that we do at Ad Fontes and keep the Ad Fontes podcast going, as well as our publications, like I said at the start, we would love you to become a paid subscriber. And at the minute, we are, have a special offer for current Ad Fontes subscribers and new Ad Fontes subscribers. An exclusive ebook produced by the Davenant Press called Why Protestants Convert. This is co-authored by our president, Brad Littlejohn, and Chris Castaldo. If you know people who have swum the Tiber or felt the pull towards Rome, or let's even imagine you've experienced it yourself, this little book will prove very helpful. It's punchy. It's less than 100 pages. Diagnoses this phenomenon that some of us will have experienced of people feeling the pull from Protestantism and evangelicalism towards Roman Catholicism, and suggests why actually the Protestant tradition has the resources and more to answer those questions and what people are looking for. So that's a free ebook of Why Protestants Convert. If you subscribe to Ad Fontes today, if you're an existing subscriber, you will get that later this month in September. Hard copies will be on general sale at some point in the future, but if you want it now, subscribe today. Great. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It was fun.
And this is the Ad Fontes podcast. We are the writers and editors, and we will see you next time.